This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm TJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford. And this is the history of Singapore. Episode 8, Orang Cina Malaya. Last week, we discussed the beginnings of the political trade union movement in the early 1900s, which would later become the most influential force on Singapore's independence movement in the 1950s. It arose out of a combination of traditional political labour, the new ideologies of workers' rights, human rights, nationalism and self-determination, and of course the desperately poor and exploited circumstances of the people of Singapore as a result of colonial capitalism. But it's not enough just to be angry and frustrated and fearful about your future. It's not enough to just have a problem. For a movement to arise, you need an answer. And in particular, there were two interrelated forces which would provide this answer to the labour movement in Singapore: Chinese nationalism and international socialism. But it's not just labour, of course. The Chinese Revolution impacts Malaya on far broader terms than just labour. As I briefly mentioned in episode 5, the Chinese and Indonesian revolutions had a major impact on Singapore's decolonization in numerous ways. So, this week, let's talk about the Chinese Revolution. Now, in the 19th century, the government of China did not have much of an interest in Singapore. Earlier dynasties had links to maritime Southeast Asia, and in particular to Malacca and Java. And of course, there was Zheng He's famous voyage. But the Manchus of the Qing dynasty were oriented towards the lands that they themselves had come from, the interior of China, and neglected the seas to their south. So it was not till 1877 that a Chinese consulate was opened in Singapore, despite Singapore's importance to trade with China. But very rapidly, the Chinese became active participants in Malaya's politics. So 2 weeks ago, we talked about how the Islamic reform movement was a Muslim response to the ideas of nationalism and democracy, civil rights, rationality, equality and progress. A response to the collapse of the Muslim Ottoman Empire in the face of superior Western technology and the colonization of the Middle East by Western powers. When Islamic reform arrived in Singapore, it interacted with the local Malay population by forcing people to ask, who is Malay? Who is Muslim? What do those mean? Are they the same thing or different things? The Chinese reaction to nationalism and self-determination, democracy, civil rights, rationality, equality and progress, to the humiliations of China and the Chinese civilization against the Western powers and Japan, similarly asked the same questions of the Chinese. Who is a Chinese? What is a Chinese? And what is the meaning and purpose of the government of China? How do we protect our civilization, our culture, in the face of this overwhelming existential threat? And the answers to these questions fell into three categories: the royalists, who wanted to preserve the imperial system; the reformers, who wanted a constitutional monarchy like the British; and the revolutionaries, who wanted to sweep away the old system and create a republic. This debate, this internal conflict, was exported to Singapore primarily by the reformist and revolutionary factions because they vied for the financial and political support of overseas Chinese. So, in another commonality of Singapore's history, it's not the Chinese government which changes Singapore, it's those who oppose the Chinese government. And indeed, you can say that Singapore's history is defined by men, and unfortunately almost always men. Singapore's history is defined by men who opposed or defied authority. So it is the great reformer Kang Youwei and the revolutionary Sun Yat-sen, two Cantonese men, who visited Singapore and exported ideas of race and nation, of reform and revolution, of class and society to Singapore. It's difficult to say how much they actually cared about local circumstances in Malaya, as both were focused on raising money and support for China. But what is indisputable is that they both had a massive influence on local politics in Singapore by introducing new ideologies, by creating structures and networks, by establishing precedents that would outlast them. Let's start with Kang Youwei. Kang found the British sympathetic to his reforms, and in particular, his emphasis on education and social reform found a very enthusiastic response in Singapore's Chinese community. And he also started or inspired a bunch of newspapers. Why was education so important to Malaya's Chinese? It would later become one of the biggest issues surrounding Singapore's subsequent decolonization movement in the 1950s. It was important because as the number of Chinese choosing to settle and have families in Malaya grew, education for their children became an important concern. And so driven by an explosive growth in the number of Malayan-born Chinese children, the number of Chinese schools in Malaya grew greatly in the first three decades of the 20th century. The Singapore government played no role in establishing or supporting Chinese schools, which were almost entirely privately established. Fierce competition forced Chinese schools to constantly evolve to meet new needs and adapt to new ideas and circumstances. Reformist ideas propounded by Kang in his reform movement, which had the goal of modernizing China's education program, quickly took hold in Singapore. And so in the early 1900s, most of the new schools which were established not only had an expanded, modernized curriculum that embraced science and geography and history, but also included foreign languages. And for schools in Malaya, English was the natural choice to teach alongside Chinese and Malay. The upheaval surrounding the 1911 revolution and the new culture movement in China also had a direct impact on Singapore's Chinese schools. In China, the reforms of the late Qing had abolished the imperial examinations in 1906 and set up modern schools, teacher training colleges, and universities. And a large number of students went abroad to study in Japan or Western countries. These students returned to China critical of traditional values, fired with new social and political ideas, and they saw themselves as the vanguard of hope and change. The rapid expansion of Chinese education in Malaya in the 1920s and 30s demanded the recruitment of many new teachers. The teachers recruited from China to meet this need were of this generation, bringing with them new ideas of social justice and self-determination. The intellectual community was further radicalized when the nationalist and communist wings of the Kuomintang violently split in 1927. Numerous left-wing intellectuals fled to Malaya and took up jobs as teachers to support themselves. And it is these teachers who would educate the entire generation of Singapore's Malayan-born anti-colonial Chinese leadership born in the 1920s and 30s. So we can see the importance of education and its intimacy to Chinese nationalism. It's not just about getting a certificate to get a good job. It is about protecting and advancing your culture, about modernizing and improving your people to meet the challenges of the new millennium. Education is a vehicle for change, personal change, political change, social change, civilizational change. Now, the other person, of course, who had a major influence on Singapore was Sun Yat-sen. Unlike Kang Youwei, the British colonial authorities were hostile to Sun Yat-sen's revolutionary ideology, which they not only disliked and which they feared might jeopardize relations with the Qing government, but they also feared would stir up Malayan Chinese against the colonial government. So they actually banned Sun Yat-sen from coming to Singapore for 5 years between 1900 and 1905, but his associates continued to visit. It is the workers' clubs founded by Sun's associate Yao Lit in Singapore and Kuala Lumpur around 1900, which are the first organizations in the country, in Malaya, to associate themselves with the cause of revolt. The rich merchants were not really interested in overthrowing governments, so Yao Lit seeks to organize and radicalize workers. And it is the Singapore branch of the Tong Meng Hui, founded by Sun Yat-sen during a visit in February 1906, which would serve as the headquarters of the organization for the next 3 years. The headquarters today, that same building today, is the Sun Yat-sen Memorial Nanyang Hall in Balestier. Have you ever wondered why the Singapore government venerates a foreign leader of a foreign revolution? There are actually two important reasons for celebrating Sun Yat-sen in Singapore, but neither of them are really explained in the exhibition. The more important one is that Sun Yat-sen was a left-wing revolutionary. Sun Yat-sen's legacy in Singapore is his role in the creation of left-wing revolutionary politics. He co-founded the revolutionary Kuomintang, whose left wing would organize political labor activity in Malaya and later found the Nanyang Communist Party, which became the Malayan Communist Party. You see, unlike in China, communism started separately and then merged with the Kuomintang in 1923. But in Singapore, in Malaya, the left-wing revolutionary movement grows out of the Kuomintang and is a direct descendant of Sun Yat-sen's left-wing revolutionary ideology. And indeed, arguably, the Malayan Communist Party is the true heir of Sun Yat-sen's revolutionary republican ideals. So, Sun Yat-sen Nanyang Memorial Hall is really a shrine to the left-wing revolutionary republican movement in Singapore. Now, there is something you will never find in your school history textbooks, I guarantee. But it's true. The second reason for commemorating Sun Yat-sen is, of course, the legacy of the 1911 revolution, of which he was an important figure, but by no means the only figure, and its influence on Singapore's nationalist and independence movement, which also fosters a debate about nationalism and self-determination, about what it means to be Chinese or Malayan, but also the structure and purpose of government and society. And when we return, we'll talk more about that. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Thum. If you've just joined us, this is The History of Singapore, Episode 8, Orang Cina Malaya. Welcome back. As I mentioned previously, the failure of the 1919 Paris Peace Conference to honour Woodrow Wilson's principles of self-determination and the disillusionment that followed fueled a series of popular protest movements across the Middle East and Asia. In China, these demonstrations, which started 4th of May 1919, gave a political edge to the New Culture Movement, which called for fundamental modernization of the entire fabric of Chinese society. A protest at the peace conference's decision to award German possessions in China to Japan erupted in Singapore on the 19th of June 1919. The colonial government called in troops to suppress the demonstrations and swiftly enacted martial law. However, the genie was out of the box. The 1919 incident would inspire dozens of subsequent movements. Many were inspired by the riot as a symbol of mass participation that exemplified the strength of concerted effort. So 1919 to 1932 was a time of protests and boycotts and mass movements in Singapore. They were initially organized to celebrate China's holidays or to protest Japanese imperialism in China, but it was underlying anger at local colonial policies, such as tax or education or immigration, or transport, or housing, provided fuel for protesters' anger. They were inspired by the ideals of the Chinese Revolution. or the connection of Japanese imperialism to British imperialism. And so protesters chanted anti-British and anti-imperial slogans alongside nationalist or anti-Japanese ones. As the movement gained sophistication, anti-Japanese protests were deliberately used as cover to rally opposition to local discrimination. For example, the 1932 Canton Commune Remembrance Rally was actually designed to focus attention on the widely hated Immigration Restriction Ordinance. These protests swept up large numbers of people and forced them to confront their identity as Chinese. Who is Chinese? What is a Chinese? Can you be Chinese and Malayan? Who are you loyal to? Where is your homeland? And for many of these Chinese who were born in Malaya and had never been to China, their response was, well, I am Malayan, and Malaya is my homeland. I was born here, I'm going to die here, and I'm going to fight for it. Chinese nationalism also led to a boom in Chinese newspapers. Because Chinese newspapers were a major vehicle by which the ideas of nationalism and self-determination arrived in Singapore and then were spread and discussed amongst the Chinese. The royalist versus reformist versus revolutionary ideological battle was fought out in the Chinese press, turning it from an obscure, isolated and passive medium at the end of the 19th century into, by the second decade of the 20th century, an effective and dynamic mass medium. The ideas of self-determination and the debate over nationalism became ubiquitous in Singapore's Chinese newspapers, particularly in the section of the newspaper that published contributed essays and literature and letters to the editor. These sections first appeared in 1907, but they became massively popular because of the engagement of the public with these debates, and by the 1920s became a standard feature of Chinese newspapers. These sections were edited by the younger immigrant Chinese, freshly graduated from Chinese universities and thoroughly comfortable with the new modern discourse. These are the social media of 100 years ago. And a hungry public devoured this writing. From 1919 to 1932, Chinese newspaper circulation increased from around 4,500 to over 40,000. 10 times as many newspapers every day in just over 10 years. New newspapers sprouted, including the Nanyang Xiangbao and its chief rival, the Hsinchu Jitbo. By comparison, English language newspaper circulation merely doubled in that period from 5,200 to 11,750, which remained only one quarter of the circulation of the Chinese press. And it wasn't just Chinese ideas. Ideas arrived in translation from the West. Rousseau and Locke were cited in discussions that compared the freedoms enjoyed by people in Britain to the lack of those same freedoms in Singapore. Writers kept highlighting this hypocrisy. Ai Tishan in the Le Bao on 17th June 1930, for example, he attacked the empty words of the colonial government, writing, quote-unquote freedom and quote-unquote equality are just words used to deceive the people. In actuality, the two are only reserved for the elites. The Chinese in Singapore were well aware of British freedoms and of their absence in Singapore, and writers were very sophisticated. They discussed the implications for Singapore of the latest theories like Hobson's theory of imperialism and its subsequent expansion by Lenin and other intellectuals. These newspapers became increasingly outspoken, their writers vigorously attacking social injustice, international imperialism, and cultural decay. Discussion revolved around issues of nationalism, self-strengthening, and enlightenment. And along the way, the debate was localized to Malaya. It wasn't just about ideology, it was about how these ideas applied to Malaya. It became about Malaya's issues, Singapore's issues. And so, by 1927 or so, Singapore's new culture movement reflected local themes, local issues. It had declared independence from the ancestral land. The movement was a Malayan movement about Malaya. Which is not to say that the Chinese themselves had become Malayan. This is perhaps the halfway point of a conversion in identity consciousness among the Chinese of Malaya from being Chinese to being Malayan. It would take another 30 years, another generation, for us to be able to convincingly say that the process of identity conversion was complete. But we can say that at this point, the Chinese were fully engaged with nationalism and politics in Malaya, that Malayan issues were just as important as Chinese ones, that the Chinese community was fully politicized and participating in the politics of Malaya. So this brings us back to the labor movement. As I mentioned from the outset, Western-type trade union organizations were linked with the rise of Chinese nationalism and radicalism, starting, of course, with Sun Yat-sen and his revolutionary Tong Menghui. After the events of 1919 drew the mass of Chinese into politics, the Kuomintang's left wing organized modern labor organizations to obtain support and funding for its activities in China, including the Nanyang General Labor Union in 1926. Next week, we will discuss how left-wing revolutionary socialism grew rapidly among the Chinese, driving forward pro-labor, anti-colonial and anti-Japanese activity. But it's not just Chinese. It was also combined with Indonesian sources of socialist thought and organization. And it reflected local circumstances, local concerns. And together they produced a Malayan socialist movement. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. And if you'd like to support this podcast, visit patreon.com/pjthumb. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.